Hello.
Good morning.
My name is Teal Brown. I'm with the Aspen Institute, and I'm delighted to be here to introduce your speaker this morning, the editor-at-large of Newsweek, having written, I believe, over 100 cover stories, and now a professor at Princeton University. Immediately following this discussion this morning, there will be a book signing of his book, Sea of Thunder, and that will be just right outside this room. So without further ado, Mr. Evan Thomas.
Thank you, and good morning.
Good morning.
Know your enemy is such an old expression in so many cultures, and yet the amazing thing is how often nations go to war not knowing their enemy at all. The most recent example, obviously, is Iraq, but you can go back through history every century, every decade, and find examples of this. I deal a lot with this question writing for Newsweek, because I write a lot about Iraq, and I write a lot about problems of intelligence, and I want to talk particularly about that in the Q&A. But before I do, I want to tell you about a book I wrote, partly because I hope you'll buy it, but also because it started out as a naval history, but it became really a case study in cultures misunderstanding each other with catastrophic effect. This is a book about the Pacific War, really about the Battle of Leyte Gulf, but let me just walk you through it a little bit and you'll see what I mean. Let me set a scene here. Imagine, if you can, that you are standing on the bridge of a destroyer in the Philippine Sea on October 25th, 1944, shortly after dawn, and you see rising up in the morning mist the distinctive pagoda-like superstructures of the ships of the Imperial Japanese Navy. Now, in World War II, it was very unusual to actually see, for an American sailor, to actually see an enemy ship. Most battles were fought at night, some battles were fought at night, or over long ranges by carrier-based aircraft. But on this morning, the men on the USS Johnston, this little destroyer, looked at, and there they saw the masts and the guns of 4 battleships, 8 cruisers, 10 destroyers. They were totally outgunned. Just to give you a sense of proportion here, a Fletcher-class destroyer weighs about 3,000 tons fully loaded, as much as the turret on the battleship Yamato, the largest battleship ever made, ever built. It had the largest naval cannon ever built. Right there on the horizon, they could see its guns winking, and they could actually see the shells, 18-inch shells coming overhead, and they could hear them. The men on board said the sound of these shells sounded like freight trains passing overhead. On the bridge, one of the seamen ducked, and the captain, Ernest Evans, said, "Don't duck, son. If you hear it, it means it missed." Sitting in the 40-millimeter gun tub right in front of the bridge was a fellow named Bill Mercer, and I interviewed him many, many years later. He was at the time an 18-year-old seaman, and he heard the captain say, "Flank speed," and he thought, "Thank God we're getting out of here." And then he heard the captain say, "Left full rudder," and he watched as the bow of the Johnson swung around until it was aimed straight at the Japanese Navy. Mercer told me that he reached down and he put on his life jacket, and he began to wonder how his mother would react to the news of his death. And so began the greatest and last naval battle of the Pacific War, greatest naval battle ever fought, Battle of Leyte Gulf. Curiously, most people have never heard of it. They've heard of D-Day and maybe Midway and great battles of Europe, but they haven't heard of Leyte Gulf, and I was puzzled by that. Why is that? Because it was in a huge battle, covered the size of Great Britain and involved more than 200 ships. It meant the end of the Japanese Navy. It was an enormous battle, and I think the reason why people don't know about it, and I venture most of you don't know about it, is because both sides screwed up. The American commander, Admiral Halsey, fell for a Japanese fake. He took his main battle force, steaming up to the north, chasing what were decoys, Japanese decoys, an elaborate Japanese deception, opening the way for the main Japanese fleet to come in cutting behind him and to attack General MacArthur's landing force at the Philippines on this day. This is the couple of days after the invasion of the Philippines, making vulnerable MacArthur's landing force. Halsey basically just blew it. But the Japanese commander, Admiral Kurita, also made a mistake, at least in the estimation of most naval historians, and certainly the Japanese. He was right on the verge of doing real damage to the American fleet when suddenly and mysteriously he turned around and sailed home. It's still a puzzle why he did this in Japan. They call it the mysterious retreat. Well, I got interested in this and curious about it, and I decided to go to Japan and to find out more. Now, to learn more about what it was about Japanese culture in particular that affected the Japanese forces here. And somebody like me, a middle-aged white male who speaks no Japanese, is going to be out of luck in Japan. I was lucky to have the Newsweek office manager, a woman named Hideko Takayama, who knew everybody, and we tapped into the Japanese Imperial Navy Old Boy Network. There really is such a thing, believe it or not, still. And I spent a lot of time talking to some interesting characters, including one who had been a lookout on the Yamato, who during the course of this lunch took off his shoe and sock so I could feel the pieces of the battleship that were still in him. He had 29 pieces of shrapnel still in him from this battle. The most interesting thing I did was going down to the Japanese Naval Academy, Etajima. And I got a real sense of the Japanese ability to hold conflicting ideas in their head. The Japanese have a great sense of obligation of duty, they call it giri. And they have an obligation to their emperor, an obligation to the people they lead, an obligation to their family, to their wives, roughly all in that order. And the young Japanese midshipmen down there are basically taught all these obligations, but that they are conflicting. And it's confusing for them because on the one hand, the Japanese, since World War II, are against militarism. Militarism has been written out of their constitution. Yet, on the other hand, they are required, as young midshipmen, to go to their museum right there on campus and visit these two galleries that that are filled with letters written by young Etajima graduates during World War II, letters home to their mothers, explaining why they're about to die the next day. Some of these letters are written in blood on Japanese flags. And so the message to these young officers to be is contradictory. On the one hand, war is bad. In fact, it's no longer known as the Japanese Navy. It's the Japanese Maritime Self-Defense Force. Navy is too martial a word. But they are taught that there is nothing so glorious as to die for your country. And three out of four Etajima graduates all through history have died for their country. Pretty much World War II wiped out about four or five classes entirely. And so this culture of death is not entirely gone in Japan, in Japanese culture, but it conflicts with other obligations. Well, this was important to me to understand the Japanese Admiral Kurita. Because on the one hand, he was a great warrior, and he was part of this great war machine. You don't get to be the head of the Japanese battle fleet unless you are a pretty salty sea dog and a great warrior, and he'd seen a lot of action. But on the other hand, he had a great sense of obligation to his own men. And he was given an order in October 1944 to basically go on a suicide mission. October 25th, 1944, the day of this battle, was the first day of the kamikazes, the first day the Japanese launched their pilots to go die for their country by plunging into American ships. Admiral Kurita's orders were to take an entire fleet and go on a suicide mission and sail into Leyte Gulf, knowing that they would be surrounded by the Americans and never come back, but to do as much damage as possible. Admiral Kurita understood that this was a fool's mission, and he made a choice, choosing between different obligations, choice to his emperor and his commander, who had ordered him basically to go and die, and his obligation to his men, whom he wanted to save from dying uselessly and futilely, because he knew the war was basically lost. There really was no point to this. And so Admiral Kurita, on the verge of this great victory, realizing that, yes, he could do a lot of damage, but he would be surrounded and eventually destroyed, turned around and sailed home. He fulfilled his obligation to his men. In Western terms, I think he was a hero. I think he did the hard thing. He chose the harder right over the easier wrong. He was disgraced for it. He was beached. He basically died of drink because only at the very end of his life did he admit that the reason why he turned around was simply to save his own men. Now, Kurita's number two, Admiral Ugaki, who I also write about, was the exact opposite. Ugaki was the epitome of the Japanese warrior samurai who wants to fight to the death. I wrote about him partly because I have his diary. It's very unusual to have naval diaries. They were against the law to keep a diary on board ship, both in the American and the Japanese navies. And Ugaki's diary is just a pain to death. It's all about wanting to die. He has a little poem he writes. He writes these little poems frequently. 2 weeks before Pearl Harbor, he writes a poem in which he says, you will die. You will die for the sake of the land. I will die too. That's the entire poem. That's it. And he spends most of the war trying to get himself killed and failing. By the end of the war, he is the admiral who's the head of all kamikazes. He is the chief kamikaze admiral. He sent thousands of men off to their death. And on the last day of the war, when the emperor gives that famous speech in which he talks about, it's a beautiful speech, in which he talks about how Japan must endure the unendurable and lay down their arms, and tries to explain how the war has been going. You have to remember the Japanese have been completely misled by propaganda. The emperor says his explanation for why the Japanese are surrendering is that, quote, the war is not going quite as well as expected. They have been nuked twice in 10 days. But Admiral Ogaki, when he hears this, his response is to become the last kamikaze. He takes 11 men, and he flies off on a last kamikaze mission. He dies futilely and uselessly, plunging his plane near a ship, not into a ship, in Okinawa. He gets 21 other, well, he wants to get 21 other men killed with him. Of the 11 planes that took off, 5 turned back with engine trouble, which suggests that they weren't quite as zealous as he was. But he was totally immersed in this samurai culture and this culture of death. On the American side, Admiral Halsey, the chief admiral naval commander, was very Japanese. He was a warrior. He believed in war. He wanted to die. He too was happy. Would have been happy to die an honorable death in war. But his and he was definitely a hero early in the war. At a time when we needed somebody after Pearl Harbor, when there's a lot of defeatism in the U.S. Navy, he was the guy who said, "We've got to stand up to the Japanese. We can't just crawl into a hole and wring our hands here. We've got to hit back." He led the first raids against the Japanese fleet. He was the admiral who led the Doolittle raid against Tokyo in April 1942. And most significantly, he was the overall commander at Guadalcanal, the battle that really turned around the war. And so he was a great warrior. But he was so imbued with this warrior zeal that he wasn't all that smart. He wasn't all that clever, and the war kind of outgrew him. As it became more complex, and the job of an admiral came to be to lead complex big fleets and complex evolutions, Halsey was not really up to the job, and he didn't pay enough attention to the real nature of his enemy. He overlooked the advice of his own aides, who said the Japanese loved deception. In fact, on the night before the battle I write about, he went to bed, and his own intelligence officer was trying to get to him and was not allowed to warn him that the Japanese were engaged in a deception. The Japanese loved deception. Both the Japanese and the Chinese used it all the time in times of war. But Halsey simply couldn't take this on. He was too much of a straight-ahead American, think like an American, wars of attrition, pour on the firepower, no deception. That's the way he was. That's the way he thought. And so he got sucked into a huge trap. What happened was, again, he went sailing north after some Japanese decoys, and meanwhile the Japanese came in behind him. This was all being watched from afar in Pearl Harbor by Admiral Nimitz, the Pacific commander, and they started to get radio messages, telegraph messages, that the small support ships, these destroyers and little amphibious jeep carriers down near General MacArthur, were under attack and being overwhelmed by the Japanese. And they began to wonder, where's Admiral Halsey? And so the tradition in the Navy is to let the theater commander run his own show, not second-guess him. So Nimitz held off, and he held off. But finally, he decided, at the urging of his aides, to send a telegram off and say, simply, where is Task Force 34, Halsey's unit? Where is Task Force 34? Unfortunately, a young ensign, once he was sending off this cable, there was always, they would code these cables, and they would put some gibberish at the beginning and the end of a message, typically a nursery rhyme or just some words. This particular ensign attached these words. It said, "Where is Task Force 34? The world wonders." He unconsciously borrowed from Tennyson's poem about the charge of the Light Brigade, about how sending all the men into the Valley of Death, the whole world wonders, who would have ordered such a thing? And so Halsey, and you have to picture this scene, Halsey is in what they call Flag Plot, which is the central headquarters on his battleship, the USS New Jersey, and he thinks he's about an hour away from attacking some Japanese carriers, basically wiping out the carrier force. He thinks he's on the verge of the greatest naval victory since Trafalgar. He thinks he's on the verge of the crowning achievement of his career. And a young ensign hands him a message from headquarters, from Admiral Nimitz, that just says, "Where is Task Force 34? The world wonders." Halsey thinks that he's being mocked by his own commander. And so he throws, by his account, he throws down his cap and he bursts into tears. Imagine being in Flag Plot there, seeing your admiral, this great Admiral Halsey, weeping over this telegram from his boss on the verge of this, what they thought was this great victory. He went down below, he brooded for about 45 minutes, he came back up, they turned around and sailed back down south to try to catch the Japanese coming out the other way. They missed all but a single destroyer. He basically spent his day sailing north 300 miles, sailing south 300 miles, and accomplishing very little.
Is that why they called him Bull Halsey?
They called him Bull Halsey before this, but there was a little bit more mockery in their voice after this. They called him Bull Halsey because he was a bull. He was a very straightforward warrior, and he got faked out by his enemy. The last character I wrote about, who's relevant to all this, is the captain of, I described this little destroyer, the Johnson. The captain of it was a fellow named Ernest Evans. And he was a walking reproach to the Japanese view of America. The Japanese were sure that they were going to triumph, even though they were materially weaker than the Americans, because they had superior spirit, session, and they call the word was session, and also because they were racially pure. The Americans were a mongrel race, the Japanese were pure, and Evans was himself a Cherokee Indian. He would have been considered a mongrel by the Japanese. He was sort of one-third Creek, two-thirds Cherokee. But he, too, was a great warrior. He graduated from the Naval Academy in 1931. Very unusual to see an American Indian graduating from the U.S. Naval Academy in 1931. And he was a great, himself, he was a great warrior. When his ship was being commissioned in 1943, he recalled that he had been in an earlier battle in which his ship had to turn around and run for it. And he told his men, "I'm never turning around again. If we sail in, I intend to sail in harm's way." He used the old expression from John Paul Jones, "I intend to sail in harm's way. And if you don't want to come with me, now's the time to get off." Well, his men didn't take it too seriously. They went out and got drunk that night. A year later, when they're in the Philippine Sea looking at the Japanese fleet and watching as the Johnston turned and sailed right into the Japanese fleet, they understood that their captain meant business. The Johnston attacked, went on a torpedo run, launched 10 torpedoes, blew the bow off a Japanese cruiser, and managed to fight the Japanese for another 2.5 hours, an incredibly lopsided battle, somehow staying alive because, this is an interesting technical fact, because the Japanese were using armor-piercing shells that went right through the thin skin of the Johnson. The skin of a destroyer is only 3/8 of an inch thick, and so the Japanese had these high-caliber shells that if they detonated inside the Johnson would have blown it up. But the shells went right through the skin inside, and they were fired at such a low trajectory, they were firing in one side and out the other. The Johnson stayed alive for 2.5 hours. A smaller caliber shell did detonate behind the bridge, causing a lot of carnage. I remember the expression that I talked to the officer of the deck who survived. He said to me, choosing his words carefully, he said, after the shell blew up, I picked up and threw overboard body parts in order to improve morale. A man had been decapitated, another lost his leg. Captain Johnson had two fingers blown off. He just wrapped a handkerchief around his hand and kept on going. He did very brave things. At one point, I don't know how many of you are naval buffs, but there's an expression in naval warfare called crossing the T. And what it means is that, in particular in old times, the idea was to come across the enemy, across the enemy's bow, because the enemy could only bring its bow guns to bear. You, by sailing broadside, could bring all your guns to bear. And so, almost laughably, the Johnson crossed the T on a line of a Japanese cruiser and four destroyers. And incredibly, it worked. The Japanese turned too quickly to fire their torpedoes, fired them harmlessly. Captain Evans just shook his head and said, "Man, now I've seen everything." Pretty much was the last thing he saw, because finally, after 2.5 hours, the Johnson was sunk, and Admiral Evans himself drowned and died. Now, when the Johnson was sunk, when the battle began, there were 330 men on board. And in the course of the battle, 70 men were killed. So 260 men went into the water. And they thought that they would be killed by the Japanese. Both sides in World War II would shoot men in the water, Americans and Japanese. And they thought when the Japanese destroyers closed in that they'd all get killed. There's a remarkable gallantry, actually. The Japanese destroyer captain lined his men up along the rail, and instead of shooting the Americans, they saluted them for their gallantry over the past couple of hours. There were little moments of gallantry in this otherwise horrible war. Well, then the Japanese sailed away. The Americans in the water saw an American plane fly overhead and dip its wings, and they thought, "We're seen, we'll be rescued." Unfortunately, the pilot sent in the wrong coordinates. And so the men were in the water for 54 hours. And on the first night, the sharks came. When the Navy finally rescued them after 2.5 days, of those 260 men who went in the water, there were 141 left. Now, there are about 25 of them still alive today. Maybe about 20. They're dying fast. These are men who went home, had ordinary lives, had jobs, got married, had kids. Kids went to school. Rarely talked about this incredible experience. But then after Tom Brokaw wrote his book, they did start talking about the Greatest Generation, and they started having reunions. And I tease some of these guys now that they won't stop talking about it. And it's understandable. If you've been through something like this when you were 18, what an incredible impression it would leave. And I honor these men. They really were heroes, but it's really not what my book is about. My book is about cultural misunderstanding. This, again and again, I was struck by how the Americans and the Japanese just went sailing past each other, both sides. I mean, the Americans were, before the war, they thought Japanese were silly little men with buck teeth and, you know, made cheap radios. After Pearl Harbor, they thought, "Oh my God, they're 10 feet tall, they're monsters, they're giants." The language both sides used about, each side used about the other, was totally dehumanizing. They always referred to each other as insects and animals and gorillas, and they never saw the enemy in human terms. Now, it was easier to kill them if you think of them as animals, but it also got in the way of understanding what they were up against. The Japanese particularly missed the boat. I mentioned earlier that here's a little country taking on a big country. What were they thinking? Well, what they were thinking is they had superior spirit. They had this idea, this session, this warrior spirit, and that they would bleed the Americans. They were never going to invade the United States. They weren't going to march on Chicago. They knew we had Detroit. They knew we were big. But they thought they could cause so much death and destruction in the first 6 months or so that we would give up. And we'd let them have Southeast Asia, their greater co-prosperity sphere, that we'd just go away because we couldn't stand being bled by them. Well, that's not what happened. We just kept building more tanks, more planes, more ships, more bombs, bombing them. We firebombed their cities. We killed millions of people. We finally nuked them. We weren't as brave as they were, but we were plenty brave. They as George Bush would say, they misunderestimated American bravery. With catastrophic effect. So this, to me, is just a case study of enemies. These are very highly educated peoples who totally misunderstood each other from the beginning to the catastrophic end. I'll end here, and I want to get into today, but let me just end here with two quotes that I use to begin my book. One is from Lord Nelson, Admiral Nelson in Trafalgar, who says that any officer who can't see signals clearly can do no wrong just laying his ship alongside another, an enemy ship. And that was the basic ethos of both navies. But Winston Churchill also said that war is a series of blunders, and that is true. Thank you very much. Now, I want to take questions. I'm happy to talk about World War II, but in my day job at Newsweek, I write a lot about Iraq, and I write a lot about the CIA, and happy to talk about that, too, to carry this theme forward to today. So any questions on that, I'm game for it. Yes, sir.
Well, you know, I guess sort of continuing on through history, there was the fog of war, the McNamara documentary that sort of carried the same theme about the misunderstanding. And maybe you can talk a little bit about the cultural misunderstandings going on now in terms of the way
Sure, of course. The question is, we'll talk a little bit about, you mentioned the fog of war carry forward through Vietnam, Iraq. I mean, why does the United States keep having these cultural misunderstandings? Why do we keep missing the boat?
Talk a little bit about the cultural misunderstanding that's going on right now with regard to the way we're...
Yeah, and talk about the cultural misunderstandings right now in Iraq. I mean, in hindsight, in fact, fairly soon after we invaded Iraq, it was obvious that we had... again, to use Bush's word, misunderestimated the animosity between the Sunnis and the Shiites. How could that happen? How could that happen? You may have noted, if you've been a reader of some of these post-war books and a reader of the newspapers recently, it's not that there weren't people at the State Department warning that Sunnis hate Shiites and we're going to inherit a bad situation there. And in fact, a CIA memorandum has surfaced. These memorandums have a way of surfacing after the fact, showing that the CIA predicted that the Sunnis and the Shiites would be at each other's throats and not be eager to simply implement democracy as we saw it. But as I was reading about this memo, I was really struck by an incident that happened to me in my reporting life. And it's this. I was interviewing Paul Wolfowitz before the war in 2002. And Wolfowitz barely knew me, barely knows me. He knew he was talking to a reporter. He was talking on background at the time, but still he's talking to a reporter. And he launched into a tirade against the CIA. And I'm wondering to myself, why is the Deputy Secretary of Defense, right, the number two guy at the Defense Department, bad-mouthing the Central Intelligence Agency to a reporter? And it gave me a sense of the depth of animosity between the neocons and the intelligence community. And there is a long history here. There was a feeling, this goes all the way back to Team B in the late 70s, there was a feeling that the CIA just couldn't get it right, couldn't understand the Soviet threat, the nature of the Soviet threat, and that we needed to have separate teams analyzing the same data. And I think it was the first President Bush, I think it was Graham, do you remember, was it the first President Bush who created Team B, who allowed...
Reagan
created Team B, to allow an outside group, one of whom was a young fellow named Paul Wolfowitz, to examine the data to determine that the Soviets really were further along in building up their defenses than the CIA was saying. And there's a long tradition, not just in the neocons, but in a lot of government bureaucrats, to just not trust what the CIA was saying, and with good reason. CIA analysis has been pretty bad for many years. Now, on Vietnam, they often got it right. They were more right than the other bureaucracies, but on many other things, they got it wrong. They failed to predict the collapse of the Soviet Union. They failed to, well, starting from the beginning, they failed to predict that the Soviets would set off an A-bomb in 1949. They failed to predict the invasion of South Korea by North Korea. They failed to predict the 1973 Israel war. They failed to predict that the Indians would set off an atom bomb and whenever it was 1989. Pretty much every major event, national security event, if you go through them, the CIA failed to see. And the reason is that, one, intelligence is much tougher than we think it is. Much harder to do this than we think it is. We've all seen way too many movies and read too many novels and seen 24 where we think that our intelligence services can do this in real time or rapid fire. They can't.
They can't. The CIA's record of failure is disastrous. It's not all that much worse than, believe it or not, even Mossad, even Israel, I mean, or the Brits, who are famous for being good spies. There's a story I always remember from a British senior intelligence service guy who said that in his long career in the 20th century, he was wrong only twice, World War I and World War II. you know, and that's that. If we really knew the true story of the CIA, we do some things well. We're very good at the technical stuff, spy satellites. We were able to count Soviet missiles, and we were able to look down from great heights. We were able to eavesdrop to a certain degree. Our code breakers had some success, although nothing as spectacular as the Brits in World War II. But our human intelligence was by and large a failure. We did not penetrate the Soviet Union. We did not penetrate Red China. We didn't penetrate North Vietnam. We didn't penetrate Korea. We didn't do any of that stuff. In fact, we had spectacular failures. We used to parachute people behind enemy lines. You've all seen movies of the guy in the dark of night parachuting down. We did this in the Ukraine in the late 40s. We did it in North Vietnam in the late 60s. Every single one of them was captured, round up, turned. Those dropping behind enemy lines plans were a fiasco. They were a fiasco in World War II. Remember, Churchill said, set Europe ablaze. That stuff was a failure. Mostly, we dropped a lot of arms to communist cells who could organize and make trouble after the war. But most of our attempts to stir up boom and bang and to blow up bridges had very little material effect on the war. We won World War II by taking ground, by military, by bombing, but also by taking ground. John Keegan, who's probably the best known military historian, has a history of intelligence and warfare that makes this point again and again. Intelligence does not win wars. Taking ground wins wars. The painful, hard part of war is what wins them, because intelligence is hard to do, and you get bureaucratic infighting, and the reality of intelligence is not 24. It's Paul Wolfowitz telling some reporter that he doesn't trust the CIA at all. It's the Deputy Secretary of Defense telling a reporter that he doesn't trust the CIA. That, unfortunately, is the reality. Why is this unbelievably important and possibly tragic? Because right now, when we are fighting terrorists, nothing is more important than intelligence. Right. Mm-hmm. Nothing is more important than intelligence.
But how could they miss this cleavage between the Sunnis and the Shiites and then dismiss the entire army of Sunnis and create this civil war situation?
Well, there's a long answer to that, and many books have been written about it. There are a lot of factors. A lot of them are right out of the ancient Greeks, hubris. I think my own take on why we ignored intelligence and just went ahead, it really wasn't because we thought there were weapons of mass destruction there, although we did. It's true, there was bad intelligence. But I believe, and I say this based on conversations with Donald Rumsfeld and a lot of people, Scooter Libby, a great deal of time with Libby, that the real reason why we went to war in Iraq was atavistic. It was to get even. It was because we wanted to hit somebody hard. Afghanistan was too small. We only put 500 soldiers on the ground in Afghanistan. Now, arguably, we should have put a lot more to capture bin Laden before he got away from Tora Bora, but leaving that aside, Afghanistan was not a big enough show for George Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld. It wasn't enough of a forced demonstration of American power. And the reason why we went into Iraq more than anything else was to show the world that you cannot attack the United States. We are coming after you. Now, don't get into the details on this, you know. Just make the larger statement. And that's why I think they didn't think about it. They ignored intelligence. They just went and did it. Yes, sir.
Didn't this possibly have something to do with the family feud, with the fact that George the Senior had stopped going when he went in, and that his son thought he had made a terrible mistake, took his own advisors who thought George had done a terrible mistake and decided that he was going to show his daddy he was a real man?
There's a whole pop psychology explanation of why Junior did what wanted to make up for daddy's mistake. And you know what? I believe it. I think there's at least something to it. I mean, you have to disentangle many factors here. But I believe in base human factors. I've read those Greek tragedies. I believe that stuff. I don't think it's all done at the level of high strategic concept and national interest and position papers and national security directives. I think that human factors like that do make a difference. And there's no question that young George wanted to prove something, that he could do it better than Dad. The scene that always got me, that biographical scene that always got me, was with young George, who was a very intense guy. I remember interviewing him in 1980 when his father was running, when young George was, must have been 30 or so, how intense he just was, bristling. Just, he was still drinking then, and he was just absolutely buzzing and bristling, and just had an unbelievable burr under his saddle. This is in a hotel room in 1980. I just had such a distinctive impression. And the detail I always remember was when he was coming back one night, late at night, drunk, when he was a college student, I think. He came crashing into some garbage cans outside his house, and he went in and he got his father out, and he said, "You want to go?" And his father came out, "What's going on?" He said, "You want to go?" Young George said, "You want to go mano a mano?" He wanted to fight his father. Now, a lot of kids want to fight their father, but this was a literal challenge. The father didn't take the bait.
He's 30-something?
Yeah, no, he was, this time George was in college. Was in college. They were living down on Palisade Lane, Washington. I think he was in his early 20s. But in any case, the father didn't take the bait. He just said he was disappointed in his son. There can be no crueler thing a father can say to an angry son who wants to fight with him than to say, "I'm disappointed with you." I think that is more important than all the CIA briefings ever written. Yeah.
Has the U.S. ever got it right? Is it so much culturally, or also just so much kind of post-war planning type of stuff? And if not the U.S., has anyone else got it right in history where it actually made a difference of why they won, because they knew the enemy?
Well, I think you have to go. Did anybody ever get it right? Did anybody ever know their enemy, or at least do some good post-war planning? You have to look pretty hard. I was trying to think, what was the last time a nation went to war and got exactly what they wanted? I was once offering this example, saying, well, maybe that was the Franco-Prussian War of 1870, but no, actually, it was the French who started that. So, I mean, in modern warfare, it's very, very difficult to find an example where the aggressor nation gets, in a large-scale war, gets what they want, because... Excuse me? They started it, but they only started it because they thought they were going to be attacked. I mean, it was only because they thought they were on the verge of extinction, and their enemies were. That was an intelligence success. That was actually one of the few things the CIA predicted. We're talking about the Six-Day War. That was the only. If you go through that long range of CIA predictions, they got that right because James Angleton was being fed stuff by Mossad. Did the success? Yes, actually, that's a pretty happy. I'm glad you pointed that out.
Yeah, I just said there's lots of happy stories. You said intelligence is hard, and it is hard. It's harder than what I do for a living, and with all due respect, it's even harder than what you do for a living.
That's for sure.
It's so hard that there's a lot of very serious people in the intelligence community who have professional journals. They write about the craft and the methodology of intelligence, and they try very hard to improve it. There are failures, there are successes. I think the scorecard is a lot more balanced than you said right here. I'm not sure on what basis you say that our record is even worse than other countries, because I've done a fair amount of work in this, and I don't know of the database that would let me reach that conclusion.
I
do have to ask you, other than the criticisms you level, do you have any constructive suggestions about how we can improve our intelligence?
I think
that's pretty important.
No, I take your point that intelligence is really important. His point is that I'm overstating the intelligence failures, and I'm not giving enough credit to our intelligence community.
My question is, what constructive suggestions do you have about improving the quality?
My first suggestion is that...
If you could say what constructive...
What constructive suggestions do I have for proving the quality of intelligence? My first suggestion would be that presidents not overestimate what they're going to get out of intelligence. There is a history of American presidents thinking that the CIA can do miracles for them, and they are constantly being fooled by that and disappointed by that. In fact, I'm very influenced by, you're wondering where I'm getting all this and why I'm fired up about this particularly. I just read a book called Legacy of Ashes by Tim Weiner, who's a former New York Times correspondent, which is a history of the CIA, where a lot of stuff has been declassified in the last 5 years. And he just walks us through from 1945 to the present, and it's a pretty sorry story. It's not totally new, since the Church Committee, there's been a lot of deconstructions of the CIA, particularly in the whole covert side. Now, look, of course there were some successes. I think the radios, Radio Europe and Radio Free Europe and all that did do...
So one suggestion is presidents should have lower expectations. Any other suggestions for improving the quality?
I think that our attempts at intelligence reform have not been terribly successful, as far as I can tell. We keep creating new bureaucracies. We created a director of national intelligence, which layered a bureaucracy over an existing bureaucracy. My sense from talking to people is there's no good answer here, but it's probably better to have a smaller, more disciplined, less bureaucratic human intelligence service that would really put a premium on people who could actually speak foreign languages, for one thing. That's been an ongoing problem, as we just don't have enough Middle Eastern speakers. But have a smaller, more dedicated unit. The Brits have had some more luck by being lean and mean, I gather, from reading the intelligence than we have. We do the technical side well, but our own human intelligence has not been a great success over the last 40 years. So we do need to improve that piece of it. We have to spend a lot of money on code breaking. We're apparently, I gather, not quite deaf, but the switch from analog to digital has been a real problem for our code breakers. I don't know what you do about that, but obviously spend some money on science to make sure we don't fall behind in that area, because it's really important that we be able to listen in on our enemies. So I would fund that heavily, but I'd spend less on creating new bureaucracies to oversee it.
Six terrorist attempts on the United States from